Sam, I'm glad. Thank you, Veronica. It's nice to be in the studio once again with the two of you. We're in separate rooms, but good to be in the same building and good to be in the showcase on Michigan Avenue. And Sam, I'm glad that you played that clip from Hank Aaron hitting 715. I didn't remember this was the date.
April 8th. Remember, he hit 713 on the last day of the 73 season.
Oh.
So there was a lot of buildup coming into that 74 season. He hit two in early April to pass Babe Ruth.
What do you remember most when you look back at that moment? I know you were young, but you've seen the video. What strikes you the most?
Well, I wasn't alive, actually. But the thing that struck me the most was, honestly, a black man getting a standing ovation in Atlanta.
Yeah, particularly considering the crap he had to put up with. Crap's an understatement. Mm-hmm. The abuse he had to put up getting into that. You know what I always think about or remark upon when I see that is that security was such that people could rush onto the field and pat him on the back as he was rounding second.
Yeah, the two guys, one on each side.
Oh, my God. And this is a guy who had been approached with death threats. He had no idea. Nobody knew. The cameramen that were following that were worried that they were about to capture something horrible that could happen. Nobody knew what was going to happen when those two guys, it was two or one, I think it was two guys ran onto the field and sort of gave him an attaboy as he got to third base.
Yeah, and he shrugged him off right away because, like you said, he didn't know what to expect.
Oh, man, what a great, well, and this is timely, too, because we're about to talk to Mark Kingwell after 10:30. Mark Kingwell has written a book called Fail Better. Why Baseball Matters. Not Feel Better, Fail Better, Why Baseball Matters. And you might imagine why he titled the book that way. Here's a sentence from his book. We learn best by failing, because failure is the sight of success illuminated. Can you tell this guy's a philosopher? Failure is the sight of success illuminated. Far more often, we fail without learning anything, and we think we have learned only when we have merely succeeded. A game which embraces failure as its beating heart offers a significance beyond its apparent pointlessness. And this, as in other ways, baseball acquires a status akin to art. It's a book about baseball unlike any baseball book you've ever read. But that's the truth, isn't it? The best baseball players will hit 300 this year. They will fail 7 times out of 10 at the plate. So what can we learn from that? And let's talk a little baseball in about 20 minutes. In just a couple of minutes, I want to play back for you part of a conversation I had this week with Amy Dickinson. She's the advice columnist. You read her in the Tribune and elsewhere, and she's written a couple of books. And she said something kind of remarkable in our conversation. Here's just a 3-second tease from that conversation.
John, I got to tell you, I'm almost 60 years old, and your virginity does grow back, it turns out.
She found love again. And the spark. And she had some interesting things to say about why she did not, a couple of weeks ago, go on Bill O'Reilly's show. This week, Don Rickles passed, and it was interesting to see and hear so many people reflect on it on this radio station. Steve Cochran told a wonderful set of stories about how he opened up for Don Rickles, and it touched Bill Leff in ways that sort of surprised me. I was not the biggest fan of Don Rickles. I got it. He didn't crack me up the way other people did. But it was interesting to me to see Elif, my producer's reaction to Don Rickles' stuff for the first time. She really didn't know his thing. And when you play back to the unacquainted, a Don Rickles riff about Jews and blacks and gays, or some Asians, Italians, you just go, oh, holy cow. We don't talk that way anymore. It's kind of startling in a way. You almost need a sort of context in order to fully appreciate Don Rickles. And Elif was wide-eyed. My producer, Griffin, watched for the first time this week the movie Vertigo.
It's not completely. It was second time.
Second time? Oh, no kidding. So you've seen it before.
I saw it at the Music Box when they showed it like a year and a half ago.
But you were ticked off when they showed it at the Music Box. What was your problem with the Music Box cinema showing?
Everybody was laughing. No shots at the Music Box itself. It was a wonderful screening. But everybody in the crowd laughed a lot of the time. It's not that funny.
Why? Because it's old-fashioned? Because
I think so. Anytime you go to see an old movie on the big screen, you've actually talked about this a long time ago on your show, but people laugh no matter what because it's just a different feeling. I don't know what it is exactly, but I couldn't really enjoy it because I was mad.
Well, this is a bad example, but I think all of us who saw Jurassic Park the first time, remember how exciting and amazing it was. You go back and watch it now, it's pretty comically bad. That is a badly acted, badly written, kind of cool movie, but oh my God, it doesn't hold up. That's me.
I disagree. But that's fine. I don't. It's sort of a different thing.
It is. It is completely from what we're talking about. But I mean, I guess my point is some movies travel better than others. Mm-hmm. And I think all old movies suffer from being a little wooden. And I think that's why people laugh.
Yeah, but if you bought the ticket, you should give yourself over to it.
Right.
Not, still have that defense up of being like, oh, this isn't what I'm used to.
Vertigo was interesting to us this week, though, because you at least pointed out to me, I don't know if it's new, but a list of the greatest movies of all time.
And it's pretty old. Well, the Sight and Sound is a magazine. They do it every 10 years.
And this is regarded by the snobs that contribute to that as the greatest movie of all time?
It's a pretty snobby list, yeah. And this took number one. So they do it every 10 years. They poll like hundreds of critics and filmmakers, and Citizen Kane always held the title for decades running.
Yeah.
The last time they did it was the first time that anything had bumped it out, and Vertigo bumped it to second place.
Vertigo's your new number one.
Yeah, huh? Yeah.
I know this is a snobby list because when I said to you, well, is Shawshank Redemption number one, you just smiled and looked to the side and down at your feet. As though, oh, you unacquainted.
I didn't mean
oh,
to
you
do
uninitiated.
That.
You silly, silly man.
No, I mean,
that's what you did.
I'm a fan of The Shawshank Redemption as well.
It's the best movie ever.
That's what you'd find at the top of the IMDb ratings list.
That's a thing.
An equally valid list, yeah. But it's just a different coming from a different perspective.
So, is Vertigo the best movie ever made that you've seen? Is it? Do you go? Holy
I don't know.
Cow, it's awesome.
It's great.
It really is good. I was thoroughly enjoying watching it for the once and a half time myself. So, Vertigo. If you want to get your movie snob on, this is our tip of the week. Just go. Well, Vertigo is number one on the Sight and Sound.
Yeah,
Sight and Sound list. Amy Dickinson. Our conversation was about two things. We meant to talk about her book. We started talking about why she didn't plug it on Bill O'Reilly. I'll play back part of that for you in a minute on WGN. Amy Dickinson's new book is Strangers Tend to Tell Me Things. We started our conversation earlier this week talking a little bit about Bill O'Reilly's troubles, but I want to play back part of the interview, in part because at the end it is just such a sweet little few things she had to say.
I know we'll talk about my book, but I am here on a media tour and book tour and visiting bookstores in different cities. And I will say I had an opportunity to go on the Bill O'Reilly show last month when my book first came out. And I've been on the show before. And after thinking about it for about 5 seconds, I said, I cannot accept this.
Because of the recent allegations against
him? No, not because of the recent allegations, because of all of the allegations. This is not new. Bill O'Reilly could care less whether or not I'm on his show. It was a real opportunity for me, but what I'm trying to say is this. There comes a point where his brand, so to speak, based on his behavior, which is real, his brand is so bad that I don't want it to touch me. You know, not to mention, I don't want to be in a room alone with him. And I mean that. No, I mean that because I've been in the studio with him.
And what's his personal behavior like in
You know, it's funny. Like years and years ago, when I first did the show, I've described this to many people as one of the strangest experiences in my life. It's a large studio with a round desk at the time. And it was set up sort of like a Charlie Rose thing, although there was no warmth. It was very cold. And the entire studio was dark except this pin spot over the desk. And what I remember so vividly was that he never made eye contact with me. Mm. And I know he might have like a social disorder or Asperger's or whatever, but it was so noticeable. It was like a refusal to connect with me. And it was very, very strange. When the segment was over, he didn't thank me. And it went very well. I mean, he was pugilistic and I punched back. You know, it was great.
No, you're a good interview.
We were laughing. When it was over, he cast his eyes down and he never said thank you or goodbye. And a producer sort of tiptoed in and led me away.
So what's the read on that? Does he have psychological issues? Has he got women issues? Is he can't be so intimate is actually looking a woman in the eye as he's talking to her?
I thought that it had to do with just a basic inability to connect with someone. I think it's probably pretty common with other people who have met him. I also, even at the time, he had a producer of his had just made he had just settled a case with a producer.
The number's staggering, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah,
the number
totally.
Is staggering.
And even at the time, I remember thinking, he is not interested, in quotes, in me. I'm roughly his age. I have nothing of interest to Bill O'Reilly. I'm little. I'm brown-haired. You know, I got nothing for this guy.
Well, I mean, clearly you don't agree with them, but I always thought that makes for good conversation,
oh,
too.
Yeah.
If you all are respectful, let's stop talking about Bill O'Reilly and talk about your books. So The Mighty Queens of Freeville was a biography written by you.
Well, it's a memoir.
It's a memoir.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Steve and I were kidding. Most of us would be happy if we lived a life so interesting that one book would contain it. But no, you have two books about you by you.
And you know the irony is that...
And you're not an egotist at all. So I thought, now, how do you justify that, Amy?
Okay, so I'm going to tell you. The irony and like the big inside joke about both books and really the point of these books is that I have not led a fascinating life. I have not. My life has been completely average. And by average, I say it has been full of drama, personal drama. It has been full of heartbreak, pain, loss, grief, love, laughing, all of it. And so, honestly, with this book, what I chose to do and really what I feel when I see it and when I talk about it is it's about opening up my life to my readers and to the people who write to me with their problems. And I'm not saying, oh, your problems are little. Look at me. You know, what I'm saying is I get it. Look at me.
Well, the title of the second book is Strangers Tend to Tell Me Things, which is, of course, your sort of occupation, but maybe it's also your disposition. I wonder if you were not doing what you do, is there something about your personality or your persona that lends itself to people doing that sort of thing?
I think there is. Honestly, I think I look open.
Because Bill O'Reilly was talking to me, and he said that he's got nothing to say to you. He said he's nothing there.
No, I missed a flight recently. I'm on this whirlwind book tour, and I actually, at the time when you can least afford to do it, I missed a flight because somebody had engaged me in conversation. And honestly, it was my responsibility. I was so interested in what she was saying.
Really?
That I missed my flight.
Wow.
Yeah.
Boy, that's a... Good for you that you can be that kind of a person. That's a very generous person that gives their attention when they know full well they've got a flight around the corner. You write about your second husband, who is somebody that you knew at the age of 10 or 12, right?
Yeah. Bruno and I first met. I grew up on a farm in this tiny village in upstate New York. And Bruno and I went to high school together. His family farmed about 3 miles away. And yeah, I've known him my whole life.
On and off, or had you stayed?
No, you know, I knew him in childhood, and then here's where this is kind of an Ask Amy situation. I knew him in childhood. He stayed home. I left. He became a builder, a contractor, a home builder, a business owner, and I moved back to my hometown to do what 4 in 10 Americans are doing, which is taking care of a family member. And I moved back home to do that. And I needed to renovate my mom's house a little bit because she was disabled. So I called old Bruno, who I had gone to high school with, who, you know, is a really good builder. And it was like falling into the cheesiest Hallmark Channel movie.
Did you have a little bit of an agenda when you called him? You could have called anybody.
I did. I had caught glimpses of Bruno over the years. And I talk about this in my book. And that zing, you know, zing, zing. Yeah, I definitely had the zing, zing. But I wasn't really aware of his situation.
How old were his situation, meaning?
He had been divorced for about 5 years.
Was he single? Was he eligible? Whatever.
Right. I wasn't quite aware if he was eligible. And once I learned that he was eligible, I called him.
Then you said, maybe could you do my other bathroom? Could you mow the lawn?
He actually declined to do this renovation. And I remember calling my best friend afterwards and saying, like, oh my God, I would pay this guy just to come to my house and have coffee with me.
He was, the electricity was there at least on your end, right off the bat.
Yeah.
He's a really good looking guy, isn't he?
He's a doll.
Did you ask him to mow the lawn with his shirt off like they did him?
It did have that quality. Yeah, he's this burly guy. Yeah.
Had you had that sort of a passion for somebody prior to that? Had it been a while since you sort of found that sort of love welling up in you, and was that very exciting when it happens?
John, I gotta tell you, I'm almost 60 years old, and your virginity does grow back, it turns out.
Isn't it nice to know that you can feel that again?
Yes, it had been a million years. I was single for almost 18 years, and I had not dated very much. And I really felt like this is it for me. I am going to be living with my mom, you know, the spinster forever. And this really, the good thing is this, I did sort of internet dating. I tried this and that over the years. And I felt like it had polished me up for the show. You know, when this man walked onto my porch, I was like, oh, I'm ready.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
How I wish that for people in your circumstance. I don't think so many people are so lucky to have that moment.
That's, I know. It was
amazing.
Pretty great. Huh. And you know what? Times since our meeting and marriage have been tough. And there are times, I think any married couple, there are some times when all you've got is that wonderful zing zing memory of when you met, you know?
Amy Dickinson's book is Strangers Tend to Tell Me Things. God is my witness when she said, you can get your virginity back. Sam Panionovich sat up straight and said, what? It's a 10:30. The news is next on WGN. Thank you, Veronica. 10:38, WGN. This is John Williams. The Mincing Rascals broadcast of our podcast comes your way after 11 o'clock. And the gang talks not only about the events in Washington, D.C., but also in Chicago. We had a lot to say. You'll hear Steve Bertrand and company talk a lot about some of Rahm Emanuel's plans, and then we'll move on to Washington, D.C. The Mincing Rascals podcast you can subscribe to wherever you subscribe to your finer podcasts, and we post it at WGNradio.com. In our studio is Mark Kingwell. His book is Fail Better, Why Baseball Matters. Ironically enough, on this, the anniversary of Hank Aaron hitting his 715th home run. Cozy up to that microphone a little bit better there, Mark. I meant to push that in front of you. How are you?
I'm great, thanks, John.
You can actually move it around here so I can see your hands and face, sir. There we go.
How's that?
Yeah, better. So Fail Better. What a cool book. What a fun idea. The meaning of it, meaning I guess most of us would immediately guess, baseball is a game of failure. You can learn something from baseball and life if you learn to embrace the opportunity that failure presents.
Yeah. The title itself, I should say, I wish I'd coined the phrase, but it comes from Samuel Beckett, who in a late work, when I think he already knew he was on his downslope, said, try again, fail again, fail better. And this has become a mantra for a whole bunch of people. Stan Wawrinka, the tennis player, has it tattooed on his arm.
Fail better.
Fail better, yeah.
No kidding.
And it became a thing in Silicon Valley as a sort of philosophy of endeavor. And so to embrace failure as something that's inevitable in human affairs, no matter what we do, there's going to be failure. But the idea that next time when you try something, you're going to be maybe just a little bit better. And I think that really captures something for me about life and about baseball. And I mean, you know, the obvious thing about baseball, a really great hitter, a legendary hitter, fails 6 times out of 10. A very, very, very good hitter fails 7 times out of 10. But it's also a game that embraces the idea of a perfect game. So you've got these kind of paradoxical things coiled in the heart of the game.
You also write in the book, though, and this is what my sons played baseball. We all did, right? You played baseball. In fact, a lot of this is through your filter as you talk about it. But the difference between a 250 hitter and a 285 hitter and a 300 hitter, you know, there's average, pretty good, and really good.
Yeah.
It's just a hit a month for some of these guys.
Yeah.
And
well,
those of us parents who would stand on the sideline rooting for our kids, or those of you who played the game, know that just one duck snort getting through makes a world of difference.
Yeah, I think a lot of people remember that scene in Bull Durham where Kevin Costner makes this point as Crash Davis. You know, one seeing eye grounder, one dribbler, one, you know, that bounces off the plate or the base in a different way. And yeah, then you're 300 or 275, and that's how you get from the minor leagues to the major leagues, which is kind of crazy, but
yeah,
true.
Yeah, I know that. Well, and I'm not sure the baseball is good for that. That is, all the things we've said so far and will, I'm not sure baseball gets it right. If you had a 350-foot shot to center and they catch it, that is all you can ask a batter to achieve. That should be a measure of success. It's not. It's a measure of failure.
Yeah.
And the grounder between short and third is superior. That's... there's something fundamentally wrong about that.
Well, it is fascinating. One of the chapters in my book is a survey of my favorite slang terms in the game.
Yes.
And one of them that I remember learning when I was probably 11 or 12 is warning track power.
And what a shame.
There's nothing worse, than having warning track power. It's like the B-plus of baseball.
Well, the first one in your list of slangs that you said you like, and I've enjoyed this phrase before, although I never even put it in those terms, was catcher's indifference. What is that?
Well, defensive indifference.
Defensive indifference.
Yeah, so that's when a play could be made but isn't made because at a certain stage in the game, the fielding team doesn't think it's worth trying.
Worth trying. So typically that's when you advance to second.
Yeah.
It doesn't count as a stolen base then.
That's right.
Right.
So a guy walks to second basically because the catcher doesn't make a throw, not thinking it's worth it.
As a baseball fan, what do you make of the automatic pass to first base this year?
Well, it's funny because I've been asked this question now many times, as you can imagine. I'm against it. I think probably not surprising. Major League Baseball said that they want to do this to speed up the game. And yet the stats show that the four-pitch intentional walk takes, on average, 17 seconds. So if you really think that you're going to improve life by gaining back 17 seconds, I think your conception of life is wrong.
Do you think the game is too long?
No, I don't, actually. I mean, I do think, by the way, in the four-pitch intentional pass, lots of things can happen. You know, the pitcher can sail the pitch, the catcher can miss it.
Somebody batter can reach out.
Exactly, batter can reach out. Lots of things. It's still part of the game. I don't think games are too long. I think it's true that there are certain pitchers, for example, who try to extend the time they take between deals, and you know, an ump will call them on that. I think that's fair game.
Fixing their batting gloves. Everybody has a routine out of the box
right now. Yeah, Garcia Parra was the one who had this almost OCD-like...
It was. Yeah. Chuck Knobloch used to do a thing with his batting gloves, and other people, I think, started to copy it because until he lost his mind, he was a pretty good hitter.
Yeah.
But I don't like the delay of the game that way.
No, I agree with that. I think I like to see the game moving at a kind of natural pace, but it is a game of pauses. And, you know, my book is kind of about... the way you think during those pauses. You're watching for bursts of action, but it's not like watching hockey or football where there's pretty much, you know, something happening all the time when the game is on. There's crouching and waiting and watching, and I think that's partly why there's been so much writing about baseball, because it becomes a thinker's game.
Is it an American game? Is it uniquely American?
Not anymore. You know, there's dispute about where and when it was invented. One thing I want to say is, as a Canadian, there was organized baseball in Toronto, my home city, before Canada was a country. There was an organized league in Toronto in the 1860s, before Confederation. It's been played a lot of different places. And now, as we know, of course, the leagues, the major leagues have changed, and the Latino players, the Japanese players, players from all over the world. And I think that's awesome.
Yeah. By the way, just as we're talking about this, are there things you would change about baseball? Can it be made better?
Well, I am one of those people who thinks that pitchers should always hit. So even though I come from an American League city and that's mostly what I follow, I think we should take the DH out of the AL. And because just think about even recent history, seeing Bartolo Colon hit a home run is pretty great.
Oh, yeah. Well, Carlos Zambrano, who was one of the all-time hittingest pitchers ever, That was fun.
Yeah.
He could pound them.
Yeah.
Well, heck, the first two home runs of the season this year in MLB were hit by Baumgartner.
Yeah, that's right. And, I mean, he's a really good hitter. So.
And those were not flukes.
Yeah, no.
He cranked.
So I think that's, you know, it should be like that. It should be side against side. And I know that would take certain kinds of declining superstars out
Some
of the
players
game.
Players would be out.
Yeah. But, and even players that I love, it might even be Jose Bautista, who's come back to us at the Blue Jays, probably going to be DHing for part of the season. But I still would rather see pitchers hit.
Baseball is a wonderful game, too, in that every basketball court is the same. No two ballparks are the same. Is that a virtue? Is that a great thing about the game?
I really think so, because it shows up the idiosyncrasies of the game, just like other features that are obvious but worth thinking about, like the fact that there's no game clock. You know, time is told in baseball entirely in outs and innings. A game can theoretically last forever. The field theoretically extends to infinity.
It's the only game where the defense controls the ball.
Exactly. Yeah. And so all of those things that make it so kind of counterintuitive to other games that dominate our consciousness, especially territorial games like football, soccer, hockey, where you're gaining. It's all about property in those games. And baseball is not about property. It's about something else. And I think that's what makes it so fascinating to people. And when you go and you spend the time there, and every field is unique, that's why people want to go to all the different fields. I don't have any desire particularly to go to other football fields. But yeah. I really, like many fans, yeah. I have this kind of bucket list of
pilgrimage
baseball fields.
To all of the yeah. fields. Yeah, buddies of mine have done the majors and even some of the minor leagues. Some people love those, which have their own sort of special feel.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I want you to talk about Wrigley Field. I want you to talk about what happened in Chicago last year. Yeah. In a minute. It's 10:47. His book is Fail Better, Why Baseball Matters. You've never read a baseball book like this. Great stories, great statistics, and reverie about the game. And told in part through your own ability and sometimes inability,
Lots
too.
Lots of inability.
Which I think we can all relate to. It's 10:48 on WGN. Pardon me. That show is good. That show is really good. I want to talk more about that later myself. It's 10:51. This is WGN. Hi, I'm John Williams. In my studio is the author of a book, Fail Better, Why Baseball Matters, by Mark Kingwell. Every year about this time, the baseball books come out. I've got a couple of them that I'm reading and enjoying, but I've never read one like yours. Did you set out to sort of find a niche that other people haven't carved into when you put your book together?
Kind of had to. You know, I had trouble when I was in the middle of writing this book because of just that. It was so intimidating to think about all the baseball books I'd grown up reading and some of the great literature that's been written about baseball. And how do you even put your toe in that water without feeling the chill?
So what was your MO then?
Well, then I thought, well, I'm going to, obviously, the philosophical stuff, because that's what I do. I'm a philosophy professor. But the way in for me was telling stories. And so I went back to basics and just said to myself, you know, my whole family for a couple of generations have been sports fans. We've all played baseball at different levels. Just start telling the stories. And that's how I got the book off the ground.
Yeah, well, I think I related to it as a fan. I'm not a great baseball fan, not like other members of my family are, but I'm a fan. And I played the game as a kid. There's a scene in your book where you describe something that I thought, again, I'm always looking for the transference here, but I think we've all had this moment. The ball goes through your legs.
Yeah.
And what happened?
Well, the chapter is actually titled Pebble, because one of the slang terms that I learned much later in life was pebble picker, which is somebody who lets a ball go by and then sort of pretends that it hit a pebble, and that's why.
They examine the soil in
yeah,
front
exactly.
of them, like, how could that have happened to me?
You even see major leaguers do it.
They do. They go, where's that spot?
Yeah. So on that occasion, what I did was just stand there as the ball went by, and one of the other outfielders ran and got the ball. And the coach was just yelling at me. You know, it's like, when you miss the ball, turn around and chase the ball.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's a lesson to keep in mind. If you miss something, don't just stand there.
There was a play 2 years ago when Starlin Castro, a shortstop for the Cubs, supremely talented, you know Starlin Castro, but the ball got through him, and he then decided it wasn't his responsibility anymore, and he thought it was in the outfield, and it was nearby, and the runner took another base, and we were just slapping our heads, because it's humiliating to chase your mistake. See, there's the transference. I'm much more literal about these things than even you are. There's your mistake. Go chase it and learn from this, you dope. Don't just ignore it.
Yeah.
And baseball does that. Talk about Wrigley Field. Talk about what the Cubs did last year.
Well, yeah, Wrigley Field is one of my favorite parks in the country, and that's not going to be a surprise to anybody listening to this because you know how great it is. But one story I tell in the book is I went to a game a few years ago when it was still easy to get good tickets, not so much anymore. And so I was visiting my brother who lives here in Chicago. I bought the tickets online. I think we were maybe 10 rows up around third base. They were amazing
wow.
tickets. And one thing I remember, wonderful. Apart from all the, you know, just the friendly confines stuff, was Alfonso Soriano was still a Cub then. And he was out in left field. And what a flirt that guy was.
Yeah.
He's just like, he's talking to people. He's, you know, posing. He's doing all this stuff. It was actually kind of awesome because, you know, just that interaction between the player and the fans, which you don't see that much of.
We had a love-hate relationship with Starling because, you know, we got him the back half of his career and we paid way too much for him. And he couldn't catch balls in left field. Left field at Wrigley evidently is more challenging than we knew.
Yeah, I don't get that either, but obviously I've never played there, so I don't really know.
What do you make of the fact that it took the Cubs as long as it did, and they did? Here's my theory. We overstated the streak. I know it was dramatic and huge and heartbreaking, but if there's only 25 teams in baseball, and there have been more and less over the years, and if everybody took a turn, over that span, the Cubs should have had four turns. In my mind, then they missed three. And they were due, but they'd only missed a few turns. They didn't miss 108 years. They missed, because every year, that if the Cubs had won every year, then Kansas City would have been ticked. Or somebody else would have said, oh my God, we're this epic fail. So maybe it was not as bad as we've made it out to be.
Well, again, you know, unless you live here, I don't know if you can feel that. But I like your statistical analysis.
That, nobody buys that crap.
No,
that
I think it's a pretty good argument. But I tell this story in the book, too. I was in Dallas last fall when the final game was on, and I was watching it in a hotel bar. And that was just an epic game. It had everything that baseball has to offer. It had, you know, delays and great plays and drama and just...
And questionable decisions by
yes,
the manager.
Absolutely.
And everybody was
yeah.
quarterbacking it.
Right. All that stuff. And I couldn't believe the love that was happening in this bar. Nobody there was from Chicago. Everybody was from somewhere else. We were in town for a conference. And yet everybody wanted the Cubs to win. Mm. And I think the maybe more interesting question now as we start this new season is how do Cubs fans feel now that they don't have that anymore, right? That doesn't provide meaning. That narrative's over. You got to start a new narrative.
I used to wonder that about the Red Sox before it was our turn. You yeah. know, do they lose part of their identity now?
Yeah. My wife is a Red Sox fan. She comes from a combined Washington, D.C. and New Hampshire family. And her grandfather, her mother's father, was in the hospital before the Sox won the title, and they were contending. It wasn't 86, it was a different year, but and he died without seeing the title, and this has been like a family thing. But now when you say you're a Red Sox fan, you don't really get to tell stories like that anymore. That belongs to the past.
Cubs fans really want to prove the legitimacy of last year's team and victory by being there again this year.
Yeah, well, you know, the Jays won two in a row, just in case people forgot.
He's from Toronto. now he's done. Fail better. Why baseball matters. Mark Kingwell. What a pleasure. Well done.
Pleasure for me. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Veronica. This is John Williams in the Allstate Showcase studio. A guy walked by a few minutes ago, and he was about my age, 50s-something, maybe late 50s. But he had a full white David Letterman beard. I don't know if that's a thing or not. Last night, they taped the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony. And Letterman introduced Pearl Jam. Neil Young was supposed to do it, but Neil Young's been ill. So David Letterman was asked to do the induction of Pearl Jam. So online now you can read all of the jokes or see bad audio clips of it because it's not ready for broadcast yet. There's not good quality stuff out there. But Letterman still got that full, gigantic, bizarre white beard. I remember when we first saw him, I think a lot of us kind of scratched our heads and thought, what is that? Is that a joke? Maybe it's the I don't have to shave every day thing and he'll get over it. He's still doing that.
I do not like that.
I love
facial hair, but that looks like the Duck Dynasty guys.
It looks like a cry for help.
Yuck.
I don't think so. I don't mind it.
I don't think it's him. I don't think that's natural. It's a statement, and I'm trying to figure out what David is saying with that beard.
Or maybe it is him, and he just couldn't do it for all those years.
Look at that. Look at that. Sam, little perspective.
Yeah, I think Sam's right.
It'd be like after all of us, you know, in the news to, you know, field finally don't do this anymore for a living, we're going to like post like crazy on Facebook because we can finally say political things.
I wonder if that's happens when people change careers or retire, and then you bump into them again at the mall and they've got bizarre hair or clothes, or they're dating a Chinese guy or just doing something that you didn't think they would do, you know? Scratch the Chinese guy.
Yeah,
I don't know.
We'll just move on from that. And then, pretend you didn't say that.
Something out of their comfort zone or your comfort zone for them. That's all.
I won't be dating a Chinese guy, but to Veronica's point, when I leave sports, I can start saying the players actually suck.
Yeah, there
you go.
There you go, because that's hard to do maybe when you're reporting on it neutrally here.
Right.
Fair enough. Speaking of reporting on things neutrally here, here is the partial broadcast of the podcast. We record the Mincing Rascals at WGN Radio, usually on Thursdays, which by Saturdays makes sometimes the playback delicate. Things are happening so quickly in this world, but you can subscribe to it and listen to it in its entirety wherever you listen to finer podcasts, or go to WGNplus.com or WGNradio.com and look for the WGN Plus tab. It includes Eric Zorn of the Chicago Tribune, Kristen McQuarrie, our own Steve Bertrand, and me. We start with the discussion about how Rahm Emanuel wants to make the standards a little more interesting and difficult for students to get a high school diploma in the Chicago public schools. Here's Eric Zorn.
Well, he's got this one innovative idea, right, which is he wants to have in hand for every student who graduates some sort of a plan for the next year. Now, I think it's a really great idea to have.
Oh, I'm going to take my hammer. Kill your phone.
You know, that's a really pathetic ringtone, Eric.
It's not a ringtone. It's my alarm. I set an alarm to remind me to come up here and talk to you guys. You just have to have a plan for the following year. It's a great idea to have a plan, I think. I think it's a wonderful thing to keep college or high school seniors with their eyes on the future, and to remind them that a high school diploma is not the be-all and end-all for most people. You've really got to go on beyond that. A lot of your future depends on that. I don't think as a requirement, as a graduation requirement, it's a good idea. I can imagine all the bookkeeping hassles. I can see the story of the kid who got straight A's who just didn't get it together to get a letter who doesn't get to then walk through graduation with his class. It just seems like it's too much daddy state.
That's unusual for Eric to rip on the daddy state.
Kind of
you
our
love
big daddy,
the daddy
yeah.
state.
So, I have the nanny state. The daddy state I don't.
What is the requirement? Because I thought I heard the mayor say an acceptance letter.
Right. Like you have to show you're enrolling in community college or
An acceptance letter would mean you would have to have been accepted at one of these places you applied.
So what do you guys think CPS's graduation rate is?
Well, he wants it to get to 86%. It's been in the 50s. I'm going to guess it's 60%. 60.
I'm going to go 61. I just want to be.
It's about 65%.
Yes!
And that's if you trust their numbers.
It's
because
better
they've
than
gotten
it used
caught
to be.
When kids dropped out, they referred to them as transfers. And actually, WBEZ caught them on that a couple of years ago. So those are if you trust CPS's numbers. So while I appreciate the mayor trying to get kids to look to the future, how about we graduate kids at a higher rate before we start adding more requirements on them? I mean, some of these, and that's district-wide. Those are schools holding up the numbers in Eric's neighborhood. You go down to Robeson and Englewood, and the graduation rate is more like 22%.
Really?
It's
that low?
Yes, it's extremely low. And you have kids who are dealing with foster home situations, parents who are drug abusers, pregnancy rates, like 1 in 4 girls in some of these schools and boys are parents by the time they become seniors. So it just seems, again, like a little tone deaf for the mayor to be going down this mandatory.
Your papers are not in order. You cannot graduate. I see this problem. Can you imagine a situation where a kid is working as hard as he can just to graduate and they go and then he hasn't or she hasn't done these extra steps to get this letter to give it to the right people?
It's a homework assignment. You write out a plan. You show that you applied somewhere, and it just gets your mind thinking to the future.
You guys really are lowering the expectations for these kids. That's a handicap in itself, right? I mean, shouldn't we ask them to do what is best for them instead of saying, oh, you've got too much on your plate, you can't better yourself?
I'm not saying they can't better themselves. I'm saying to put this extra paperwork requirement on them.
Look, don't they have to pay it? They have to pass a constitution test, and we're learning now half the people in Washington couldn't pass that test. So maybe their time is better spent trying to find a community college.
Speaking of Washington, what was that? What do you make of the representative Nunes announcing that he is going to step down from the investigation?
Well, one of the guys taking his place is Trey Gowdy.
Well, that'll muddy things up just a little bit.
Trey Gowdy of the Benghazi hearings. So I don't know. I think it's got to be a step forward, right? Because the guy had to go.
Have to go.
I don't know if they'll regain credibility.
He said
he didn't
want to be a distraction any longer. Although when asked that previously, would you step down? He said, why would I? But a week later, he realizes that he would because others realized.
I wonder who realized it for him. I'm guessing Speaker Ryan had something to do with this. They probably came to him and said, look, Nunes, or however you say your last name, it's time to go.
Yeah.
I think what happened with Bannon also.
What is to you the most extraordinary revelation from one of these investigations? What is the gun, the smoking gun?
I mean, that's a really good question. I don't know that there is a smoking gun. I would like to see Susan Rice have to answer further questions. I don't think she was truthful at all in her interviews with MSNBC. They didn't ask her the right questions. She didn't answer the question. She kept going off on a tangent of this or that. Do I think she did something illegal? No, I don't. But there is enough story and truth out there, if you read Eli Lake's piece in Bloomberg, that she was asking to unmask people at a greater pace during the transition, and that the Obama administration wanted to kind of keep some of that information and lower the standard of how it could be released so that if there was something there, it could go out. And the question with all that is, you know, we trust our government to surveil us, but there is supposed to be a really high standard of when you can unmask. And I think this brings into question what the offense is.
Here's my scenario. So they are surveilling these people, the Russians, and they find out that the Russians are talking to people. They have the conversation, right? They just don't have the identity of who they're talking to. Perhaps there's evidence there that there was some sort of collusion, some sort of quid pro quo with the Russians in these conversations of these Americans. Well, if that's the case, wouldn't it be derelict not to ask that these names be unmasked? So, you know, there was the story earlier in the transition or in the administration where the Obama people had found this information, some information, and then they kind of spread it out to congressional committees and to others so that it couldn't be hidden by the Trump administration if it was incriminating. Is what she unmasked, is that the information that they then spread so that it couldn't be thwarted by the Trump people? I mean, that seems like logic to me.
Yeah, I get that.
And this, by the way, in no way vindicates what Trump tweeted a month ago, that Obama was wiretapping Trump Tower.
No, it does not.
This is nowhere near that. And, you know, if Susan Rice overstepped her bounds here and had things revealed that shouldn't have been revealed, you know, that's a problem. But it actually is not related to this.
It just seems to me, though, like we're talking about 1A and 1B, and mostly we've been talking about 1B here. 1A is in this sort of following of these foreigners in the United States. We happen to catch them communicating with Trump administration people. That's the big topic. So Rice or Donald Trump's allegation against Barack Obama, those are all kind of distractions. They're legitimate, but they aren't the main thing that we should be focusing on, or that at least the government should be focusing on. It's this investigation into whether or not there was some sort of collusion, who said what to whom with the Russians.
I mean, couldn't you write this story where it's absolutely proper? Just because someone is saying that she did wrong doesn't mean that she did.
Is there a smoking gun? Back to your original question. I don't know, but I do think the hearings kind of help. Even the Benghazi hearings, as exhausting as they were, they helped kind of set up a timeline.
And interesting, this will bring Trey Gowdy and Susan Rice back together, mm-hmm. right? Which was so much of the Benghazi hearings.
Yeah, I would like to hear more before I say that she's done something wrong.
Okay, but it still seems to me like we're falling prey to what Donald Trump is trying to do, and that is spend a lot of national time and focus on something that is tangential to the main thing here. Who was talking to the Russians? What was being said? Was there some sort of collusion?
We do have hinkiness.
you did not say that.
Your Honor, I would like to present the
hinky evidence. What a shame
evidence.
It will be, though.
I'll allow it.
No, but we do have, thank you, Your Honor, if I may continue then. We do have Michael Flynn having these meetings, which may or may not have been okay, and then lying to the Vice
Pence,
President
mm-hmm.
and others
getting
about
fired
it.
For it.
We do have Michael Flynn not claiming all of the money he was making or had made from the Russians, and then claiming that his resignation
that's
got in the way
stuff,
of it.
Steve, whatever that is, hinkiness.
And Paul Manafort. No, I wouldn't say there's a nothing burger here. I'm going to steal from Eli. Like, there's a something burger probably with both of these stories, with Rice's involvement and with the way the Russians influenced the election. Not colluded, but, you know.
Influence.
Well,
you do agree with me, though, Kristen, right? That is really what our tension should be. That going forward, we want to preserve the integrity of the elections. So if anything, let's figure out what happened with respect to that, right? What a shame it'll be if history looks back on this period of time and reports that we found nothing, that there was no smoking gun, that this was all just flapping our jaws and had nothing to it.
Hey, that's our jobs, right?
I'm looking forward to some supremely awkward moments between Donald Trump and the Chinese. I'm just predicting, and I want to be on the record.
Something weird will happen, right?
Yes. There's going to be a look. There's going to be that awkward handshake. He's going to be moving papers around on the table.
He's going to present him with a bill. He'll do something really offensive to Chinese culture. Yeah.
That's right.
A buddy of mine sent me a text this morning and said, did you know that Trump gave Angela Merkel a bill? I'm like, well, yeah, apparently he did.
For what?
When she came into the White House, you guys saw this reporting,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
he presented her with a mock-up bill of what Germany should have been paying for NATO.
Oh, I thought for her room at Mar-a-Lago or something.
No, all right.
I actually did think that's what he was talking about. It's 11:21 now on WGN. John Williams here. That's part of our Mincing Rascals conversation. We did not mention the Syrian airstrikes, although Kristen McQuarrie anticipated that, but it was hours after that, late this week, that the airstrike happened. But Kristen had something very interesting to say about that, and I think you will probably agree with her sentiment on what has happened. Let me just play that clip after this on GM. Seems as though the president did an about-face, maybe a lot of us did, about this Syria thing. I mean, after all the images we've seen of the refugees, the little boy washing ashore, etc., the president has decided that we must do something, and he said it because he saw that video of the babies, the beautiful babies, he said, that were being gassed, and I think a lot of us were touched by that. One wonders if the president hadn't seen that video, if none of us had, would we have retaliated with our missile strike? Okay, that's sort of the backdrop against just another portion of the Mincing Rascals podcast that I want to play for you, and we start with Kristen McQuarrie.
Adam Kinzinger, who represents Central Illinois, has been really out front on this and talking about airstrikes. I don't think we can continue to sit by and watch this happen and just say, well, you know, it's not our job. It's too painful what is happening to this population. And yes, I do think that drawing the red line and then not adhering to it is a big reason for that. And you don't have to take my word for it. There's an opinion piece by honestly, I think it's
do you
time
know how that
when
thing
I
works?
Start talking. It's like,
yeah, no kidding. Yeah. He's actually got a little button he pushes.
What
yeah,
happens is
shut me up.
It's tied to Eric's pulse or heart rate. So once you start going,
exactly.
The Zen starts kicking in.
Exactly.
Starts
keep going, Chris.
So there's right wing talking points.
I know.
A couple of points. One is that back several years ago, Trump was tweeting almost nonstop about Syria for a while, saying that we should stay out of Syria. It's not our business. And Obama should keep people out of Syria. He was relentless about that.
Did who? You guys watch who? The videos
of the victims?
The gas attack.
Secretary of State.
I saw the still photos of it. I mean, the ambassador held them up before the UN. Why do you ask?
It might change your – it might move you. I watched a lot of the videos right after this happened. I happened to see something. I went on Twitter. There were people on the ground videotaping these people literally suffocating to death. I mean, it was just – it's so disturbing that I think that has impacted my thinking of, like, we have to do something.
We have to do something. But
five or six, they threw all these babies into a truck, and they were trying to rush them to the Turkish border, and they were dying in the truck.
Kristen, I agree with that, and we were moved by images of refugees as well. You know, a year ago, the little boy on the beach, the bodies and things like that, there was great public sentiment, and the eventual reaction to that was we cut off bringing in Syrian refugees. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
Those horrific images had a public impact briefly, but then we were talked out of it and shut down the other way. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how long lasting the impact of this will be.
I still have the same questions. Why can't some of the neighbor? Why can't Turkey do more? Why can't Saudi Arabia do more? Why can't some of the more geographically close countries do more to help these people?
I think a lot of us are scratching our head about that one, but I think a lot of us, too, if you said thumbs up or thumbs down on us getting more involved, I think most people would be thumbs up. That's part of our Mincing Rascals podcast. You can hear it in its entirety, as always, at WGNplus.com, WGNradio.com. We've got the GN Plus tab there. Or you can just subscribe to it and listen to it as you normally do your free podcasts. Again, we are the Mincing Rascals. It's 11:27. We'll get you into the newsroom in just a second here. Afterwards, our Vibe Score segment looks at a whole bunch of fun things on WGN.
Comedy. Now that's what I call pure comedy.
Not a commentary on the news. It's just a song.
By the way, John, Mr. Fix-It tells me I need to talk to you about houses in Indiana.
Yeah.
And because I've got one for sale.
Oh, do you really?
Yes. And he said if there's any problem that we can blame him.
Wow.
Anyway, so we should chat.
Oh, their religions are the best.
I like this song.
They worship
this is our Vibe Score segment where we take a look at a bunch of things in the news. If you subscribe to the Vibe Score app, which my cousin and I developed, we'll feed you stories, videos, topics that are of interest to you. And after each post, there's a scorable question. 1 to 100, what do you give it? We always start with a song.
When you question their sacred texts, written by a woman.
What are we listening to there, Greg? Wow.
Pure Comedy, the title track from a new album by Father John Misty.
Their language is just served.
I don't know who that is, but this sounds really good.
You remember the band Fleet Foxes?
I love Fleet Foxes.
I can't hear myself. Can we turn this down?
That's on you.
You always control that one, though. All right, well, never mind. Sorry. He was the drummer for Fleet Foxes.
And a vocalist in his own right now. So
well, they were always all about the harmonies.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
they
sure.
harmonized a lot.
Yeah. There you go. That's you, and that's not me, is it, Griff?
Yes, this is me.
on keyboard? This is you?
Trying to figure out who's hitting what buttons here.
So talented.
In the past, you've controlled the song that's at volume of this first song that we usually play.
Yeah, but I'm not this time, am I?
Okay. No, well, certainly not. That was the confusion. Anyway, he was the drummer for Fleet Foxes, and they all sang in that band. So he's got a beautiful voice,
oh,
and he's
man.
Been solo for a while now. And he's good. You like that?
Oh, yeah, I did. I did a lot. I think I'm going to listen for that again.
He was just on SNL a couple weeks ago. That's the first song, title track off of his new album, Pure Comedy.
Pure Comedy. Yeah, okay. 1 to 100. I'm going to give that. It sounds like I always give things about a 92. I'm giving that a 92. I thought that was terrific. You've been picking really good stuff for us lately.
I guess so.
Okay. Where are you on that?
I'm not the biggest fan, but I like him a lot. He's just got a great voice, and he's very wordy, very, like, literate. I don't know what exactly the word is, but I always check the songs, the lyrics of the songs, to make sure that everything's above board. And
that's drilling down too deep, Griff.
Is the word articulate?
Articulate. That's what, but going through his lyrics takes forever. That song.
I mean, just half the time I don't understand the lyrics.
It's like a book.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make sure he wasn't cursing.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
How about you, Sam? 1 to 100. What do you think?
86.
There's your gut check. Newsroom.
That's where
Veronica,
I'm at, too.
I'm just going to go 70 because it just seemed too slow to me.
A little
for you? I need some energy. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it wasn't that. Okay. Well, there's your Vibe Score. What else you got for us, Griff?
Okay. Did you see on Twitter this thing that's going on? A kid asked the official Wendy's Twitter account. Does this ring a bell yet?
I know what you're about to ask.
Okay, he asked them how many retweets he needed to get before they would give him free chicken nuggets for a year.
Yeah.
They said 18 million.
Whimsically, you'll never get 18 million, kid.
He's now at over a million.
Wow.
And counting.
Wow.
I guess the question here is, are you rooting for him?
Right, I know. Or is this just some brat kid who's slubbing off of a big corporation and they're reaping all the promotional benefits?
I believe the tweet that has got over a million retweets says something like, a man needs his nugs, which rubbed me the wrong way.
Well, was that the kid's tweet?
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding. That's the one we're retweeting, a man needs his nugs. How old is this child?
He looks like he's like 18. I can't really tell. I don't know anything about him.
That's a different vibe. If he was 7 and said, "Can I get some nuggets for a year?"
You'd say, "Get off Twitter. You're too young to be here."
Nugs, King John.
I know. Still, what the heck? I like it. I like the kid that asked Emma Stone to prom on that viral video.
I'm over that.
This week, so
I did not like that one. This reminded me of that, and I was like, you know what? You can't have everything you want just because you made a nice video, so you can get out of here.
You didn't just make a nice video. By the way, I posted because I thought if we're doing viral, which this was in the category viral videos, why didn't we do the Emma Stone one? So I posted the Emma Stone prom pitch in the What's Up category, just kind of a catch-all for us. You'll see it scroll across the top if you have the app. There's the video. You get to say how awesome you thought that was. Okay, here I go. Kid asking Wendy's, 89.
Okay.
Prom pitch, 92. That's where I live today.
Wow.
92. Panionovich, score it.
The Nuggets kid?
Yeah.
There's no such thing as a free lunch.
Wow.
65.
Tough.
See, I'm going the opposite. I'm going to go 94.
Thank you.
Because he didn't just say, give me nuggets. He's trying to earn them.
That's right. What will it take? Listen to the amount of intellect coming out of the news and sports departments today. It's been very impressive.
Well, and I was thinking about the cost of free chicken nuggets for a year consumed by one guy. How many chicken nuggets can he consume? What is that going to cost Wendy's? They're probably getting that in promotion.
Oh, definitely.
Through this silly retweets thing. So,
well, it's sort of like
it's worth it to them.
Morgan Spurlock thing where he ate McDonald's for a year. No, he ate McDonald's for 3 months, wasn't it?
No, it was a month.
Was it 1 month? He about died. That almost killed him. If you ate Wendy's nuggets for a year, that would be a bad year for you.
I think you'd be fine. I think you'd be very happy.
There's probably people listening to us going, well, I survived it on my own and I paid for them.
Yeah, true.
Okay, what else you got for us, Griff?
I give him 70. I give the Emma Stone kid 15.
Wow.
Get out.
Why are you hating on the kid?
I don't know.
He made a perfect send-up of the opening scene of La La Land with the music mixed underneath, the traffic jam. He gets out. They're holding up funny signs.
I just kept thinking about like Emma Stone watching that and being like, well, I guess if I say no, I look bad. But also, I've done nothing to... I don't want to go to prom.
With a kid? I don't owe him anything.
I don't know this guy. No, I'm being called out.
Fortunately for her, she was able to dodge that whole thing because she might look bad if she doesn't say yes. That really just puts celebrities, because everybody looks at them. A billion people now look at Emma Stone and go, are you going to be a snob? Are you
too good
for
this? Oh, come
on.
It would be so fun if you went to prom.
Go to the prom. He'll be on Letterman. Won't be on Letterman. He'll be on Jay. He'll be on one of those shows.
Well, speaking of Letterman, you're fascinated with his beard, so you reposted it.
Yep, we're vibing on Dave's beard today.
I think you got to get over it. I think it's fine.
I think it's... You know why? Here's why. Because notice the vibe post on David Letterman's beard. He was sporting it again at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony. The question asks... The enduring beard. It wasn't just a one-off. It's the enduring facial hair. What do you say? 1 to 100? Dave, 52. I want you to cut it, and I want you to think about it. Just one man's opinion.
I want to bring the math full circle on the Nugs guy if we can.
Oh, yeah.
Just to go back to that. So you can get 4 nuggets at Wendy's for 99 cents.
Right.
It would cost you $4.5 million to buy 18 million nuggets.
Right. But he just wants nuggets for a year, right?
Right. But so, I just, yeah.
If you're putting a value per tweet.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that would be a whole other way to do it. Yeah, he should have just said, give me one free nugget for every retweet.
Boy, that would be nice. But, but yeah, this is a very inexpensive thing. In fact, really, Wendy's, cut it out. Give the kid some nuggets. He's not asking for much. You've got extra nuggets.
Once again, they owe him nothing.
They're not real chicken anyway.
they don't owe him anything.
That represents nearly 2 pounds of chicken over the course of a full year.
Once again, just because someone did something online, you don't owe them anything. You don't have to give them anything. I think if he hits 18 million, they should withhold the nuggets anyway. I would love to see that.
Oh, wow.
Just the firestorm that would create, I would enjoy.
Angry people would be going to Wendy's after that.
Yeah. Give the kid his Wendy's nuggets.
I don't like kids. I'm going.
All press is good press.
By the way, just since we're on the tangent of what to do with extra stuff or stuff that isn't yours, there was a guy who was in a hotel, and he noticed that he used the soap a little bit, that little bar of soap, and then he's done with it. And they're almost, for all of us, we leave a bar of soap almost full in our hotel rooms. He called down, and they said, what do you do with it? They said, we throw it away. We can't reuse the soap. He's now got a project where they take unused hotel soaps and they send them to third world countries because hygiene kills people over there. So isn't that a wonderful thing?
That is awesome.
Yeah. I know. I'm like, what? I think they have to clean the soap. They have to boil it or something. But they reuse the soap, and it goes to people in countries where diarrhea will kill you, but for some hygiene. So what a wonderful thing.
Yeah. That's great.
Okay, keep going, Griff.
It's a real mind bender. How to clean the soap? Whoa. It makes you think. I think at one point we were on David Letterman's beard, but I'm done with that. We'll
okay,
move on.
Fine.
Can I give him a 7, though?
Thank you.
You know what? Just for that, I give him a 97.
33.
You polarized me. In sports, the Cubs are 2-2. Am I right about that?
Yes. Panny Adovich, 2-2.
Yes, 2-2.
So how are Cubs fans feeling about that?
Yeah, no kidding. I'm so okay with this. How about you, Sam? 1 to 100. 100 is they win the World Series again. And 0 would be they're terrible. They don't even make the playoffs.
81.
Your vibe for the Cubs this year?
81.
A cautious 81 from the sports department.
Yeah.
Into the newsroom. Veronica.
I'm going to go 75.
Really?
They're on a roll, but, you know.
This is the defending World Series champions, people.
Last team to repeat, 2000 Yankees.
And Schwarber is back. Although, what's Javi Baez's story today? What do we know?
Just has a bruise under his left eye.
He's okay?
Yep.
Going to play? I'm 95. There's no reason not to be enthusiastic. If you bring back virtually the same team, and they were awesome last year, how do you not at least have them in the final 7 games?
Yeah, but if the season ended today.
After just 4 games.
Then we're in big trouble.
The Reds and Twins headed to the World Series.
The Minnesota Twins, 4-0, haven't done that since 1987, and everybody in Minnesota's going, hey, we won the World Series in 1987, so maybe we're back. They lost 103 games last year. All right, Griff, what else you got for us?
In TV, Big Little Lies was the HBO miniseries starring Reese Witherspoon, Nicole Kidman, Laura Dern, and a few others. It just wrapped up. Everyone's freaking out about the ending. I think there was a big twist. Did you watch?
I can't help you on this.
No, yeah, me neither. But when it started, everybody was like, yeah, the show seems fine. And then after the final episode, everyone was so jazzed about it. So I think I am going to pick it up this weekend.
All right, well, let's see what you vibe and everybody else does on that one. By the way, I also posted 100 is you completely agree with it was the best option. 0 is it was a terrible option. The U.S. response to the gassing of civilians in Syria. We launched missiles. Was that the right choice or the wrong choice? 100 is yes. 0 is absolutely no. You can vibe on that one. There's a political category as well. And that's about it for us today, right, Mr. Griff?
That does it.
All right, that's our Vibe Score. Vibe Score is an app. You can get it free and participate with your scores. We'll review more next week here on WGN.
Comedy.
Second time now.
Now that's what I call pure comedy.
Former drummer, Fleet Foxes. Or is he still the drummer for Fleet Foxes? Sometimes the second time around helps.
Now he left. And it was a long time ago that he left. And it's been a long time since Fleet Foxes put out music. When he left the band, everybody was freaking out. It was like, it's fine. He's just the drummer. And then they never put out another album. And they're starting to come back with new music now. But
drummers get no respect.
I didn't know he had this in him.
Yeah, really. One more time, Griff. Artist and title.
This is Pure Comedy by Father John Misty.
Risen zombies, celestial virgins, magic tricks. These unbelievable
152. This is WGN. John Williams here. You hear me weekdays from 1 to 3 in the afternoon and Saturdays from 10 a.m. till noon. One other note, Griff, you'll need to do a musical segue for us in there. This has to do with the story, and John Hansen's in our studio as well. Did you see the story this week about the girl from India that was found living with monkeys
living
in the jungle?
With the monkeys, right?
The
8 years
monkeys
old or something?
Raised her in 3, 2, 1, hit it.
Look for the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife.
Everything has to have a theme song.
I mean the bare necessities.
It was a story destined for virality. What is the adjective form of viral? Virility? V-I-R-A-L-I-T-Y. Mm-hmm. How would you pronounce that?
Virility.
Yeah, but when I think of virility, I think of power, not going viral.
Interesting, yes.
But virality. I think it's... All right, how do we say it, Griff? Virality.
Yeah, I think I'd go with that.
Virality. It was a story destined for virality, and filled Facebook feeds around the world. Indian police said they had found a girl believed to be anywhere from 8 to 12 years old living with a group of monkeys in northern India. The monkeys supposedly tried to protect the girl when cops went to grab her. We spotted her playing among the apes as we tried to go near the girl. The monkeys surrounded her, and some of them pounced on us. Officials immediately said she acted like an animal, and the comparisons were seemingly inevitable to the Jungle Book, how one Indian newspaper put it. And many followed suit, comparing the girl who was unable to speak with Rudyard Kipling's Mowgli from the famous novel. The truth turns out to be not so interesting. Officials now say the girl has some disabilities, likely abandoned in the forest. They don't know how long she was living there, but they say that once she was out of that environment, she quickly stopped crawling and acting like a monkey and began to resume more normal human kinds of interaction. I don't think she speaks a spoken language, though, which is weird. And they don't know how long she was living in the jungle.
Well, that's my first question, is how long was she there to kind of, you know, I think when the story first came out, there was an undetermined amount of time.
Right.
And I think that people had said that she had some clothes on her, which would indicate, you know, a growing kid like that, you imagine. If they were there multiple years, they would have grown out of those clothes or something. I mean,
maybe the monkeys provided it for her while they were raising her into adulthood.
They packed an overnight bag or something for her. I don't know.
So our best to her and them, but yeah. It's not nearly as intriguing as you might think. Speaking of intriguing, what's coming up? So you're in for Amy today.
Yeah, I'm in for Amy today. And we've got a, you know, it's fascinating. You were talking about the mayor's choice or edict, I guess you could say, that kids have to get either an internship, military, a job, something to
college acceptance,
2-year trade school, something like that. And that kind of leads into what we're chatting with in the first half of the show today. We're talking with Year Up Chicago, an organization. It's actually a nationwide organization, but they have an outlet here in Chicago that provides kids 18 to 24 from low-income areas that have a GED or a high school degree a 1-year internship. It's classes at the beginning, and then it turns into an internship. They have corporate partners that they work with to kind of find kids these opportunities. And they have a very high success rate for kids that continue on to end up working there. I mean, obviously, as I think anyone can relate to, an internship is that great way. I mean, a lot of people hire from within after an internship. So we're going to be chatting with them about that. And I'm kind of curious what they think about the mayor's edict. I happen to like it. I know there's a lot of other people seem to think it's an unfunded mandate.
It kind of is. And I think there's also an opportunity to pop every balloon. Like when I first heard about it, I go into talk show mode. Well, what about this? What about that? And Eric Zorn said, what about the kid who got good grades but forgot to get the letter done and now he doesn't walk at graduation? There'll be a hue and cry. I'm like, stop finding every possible hole in the argument. Mm-hmm. Just live with the general idea that 12th grade isn't enough. That's what the mayor's point is.
Yeah, I was talking to a CPS, someone from the Chicago Teachers Union, and his argument was that in order to really accomplish this, they would need something like another 100 to 200 guidance counselors to be able to do this. I mean, we can't leave it up always to the parents, to the kids themselves. Someone's going to have to hold hands. But again, I agree with you. I think that there's plenty of reasons not to do something, but why not give it a shot and see what happens? You can kind of work out the kinks as you go, in my personal opinion. And people are saying, well, don't make it a requirement. Well, if it isn't a requirement, the kids aren't going
then
to do
it. Then it ain't
going
to get done. Yeah. And he said that it's like a lot of things. If you demonstrate an expectation, the kids will meet it. This is a new expectation. Mm-hmm. You have to go to school. You have to brush your teeth. Whatever it is your routine is, you have to have a letter saying that you have a plan. That's all the mayor's asking for. You should. Okay, you're going to do that in the first half hour and more still to come. Do we call it the business lunch?
Business lunch.
The business lunch.
Wintrust business lunch.
Around the corner.